G'day, thanks for joining us again. I'm Linda Ross with the Garden Clinic podcast. And the Garden Clinic podcast aims to travel right around Australia, talking to gardeners and getting the feel for what they're doing in their gardens, talking to plant experts as well, and giving you the practical tips and inspiration that you can use in your own gardens. A little bit of inspiration goes a long way, but as we all know, it's 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. Well, it is for me at this time of the year. So check us out on iTunes and give me a little rating if you can. It really helps to spread the word. If you can tell your gardening buddies about our podcast and give me a 5-star rating, I'd absolutely love it. And then we can get the word out.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.
My podcast today is all about roses, and particularly the roses that are grown in one of my favourite Australian gardens, Red Cow Farm. This is a true treasure of Sutton Forest and the Southern Highlands in New South Wales, and I had the privilege of wandering around this beautiful garden with one of its creators, Ali Mentash, and I wanted to have Ali on the line today to tell us a little bit more about this beautiful Red Cow Farm and his favourite roses. Thank you so much, Ali, for your time today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Now, look, it was a long time ago when we first met, probably 25 years ago.
I think so. It goes back to mid-90s, I think, yes.
So you and Wayne bought that beautiful little 1820s cottage in about 1990. I think I was just finishing school. And you started to create this incredible garden with 20 rooms, a series of sort of 20 rooms, each with their own mood and linked subtly, I think, with clever planting. But while the roses don't feature in every single room and every single picture of your garden, they certainly are a huge feature, aren't they, Ali?
Yes, they are. They're actually, depending on the variety of the roses, some of them are used as almost like bedding with the perennials and shrubs and particularly in some of our more strict formal areas. But as you go towards the more relaxed areas, some of the larger growing roses are allowed to, you know, take hold in their position where they just create wonderful pictures, whether it's climbing onto a bridge or a tree.
About that bridge, I suppose that's where we can start, because that is a very unique image of Albertine, a vigorous rambling rose climbing right next to that gorgeous lichen-covered bridge over the lake. Why did you choose Albertine for that spot?
Albertine was chosen because I think forest growth and again the flowers for the wonderful color, and I think most of all is also its generosity of its flowering, the number of flowers when it, even though it's once flowering, it has a good long season, and also of course its perfume. When that rose is in flower, you really smell it before you actually get to see the rose, so it just draws you in. And it's probably the lowest part of the garden, it's heart of the garden, and I think it was such an appropriate position for that rose.
It certainly does feel like it's the heart of that garden.
Yes.
So let's take our minds back, and I want you to think of that day in 1990 when
yes.
you got the keys for that little cottage, that dear little cottage.
Yes.
What greeted you? What was there?
Okay, it was actually a paddock. Initially, we were actually looking for a land of minimum 10 to 15 acres. I was probably even more ambitious then to garden, but we saw the cottage and we fell in love with it. We did accept the fact that it was on the road. In the end, it didn't matter. The place had a good feel, and of course, the surrounding land, even though the property goes back to 1820, it was actually a grant given to an ex-convict. Subsequent owners subdivided and sold the land, and when we purchased it, it was down to 6 acres of paddock. So have a lot of foresight, I think a lot of stamina, lots of willpower, and something that you really wanted, which was a garden. So we just went about planting and putting all the infrastructure into the garden, like walkways, pergolas, walls, and so on.
Yes. I do remember talking to you back in the 90s, and you said to me, this garden will be best in 25 years. And you were thinking of that length of time to create the vistas and the views and the volume and the voids, I suppose.
I think also the time we started putting the garden together, and mid-90s we were encouraged to open for the Open Gardener Scheme, and I remember telling people this area will be woodland, which was just bare paddock still, and a lot of trees were still being planted, of course, but it really does require the, you know, the time to particularly trees to establish, to give the garden a sense of belonging.
It is amazing how much belonging and how much of a sense of place it has now. Those giant woodland trees are ginormous.
Yes, they've grown really well. And the other thing that we did was, and I think that was the right decision, was to, first of all, put in quick-growing windbreaks like the radiata pines, which is not always recommended, particularly for smaller properties, but it has served a good purpose of helping us establish the garden, including good growth on the trees. And we had to make these decisions because we were learning still as we went along, like planting trees in numbers and then looking at in the future for culling, which we have been doing and we continue to do so. That seems to help establish, particularly with trees, the growth faster. You get a good rate happening. And also, too, with our trees, it's not about individual specimens, although some of them are because they're too good. They need to be grown as a specimen. But generally, it's almost like planting your perennials and your roses and so on. The trees, to me, are the part of that scheme where everything is related. It's not about the individual plant.
I think that's right. So when we wandered through, we had that lovely couple of hours together, you wandered through the different qualities of light and shade and dapple and percentage of light, I suppose, and that all plays on the carpets and the surface of this of the garden.
Yeah, particularly when we're living in the Highlands, and that's one of the reasons we moved to the Highlands, to really experience and work in a cool climate gardening. Even though some days you go through four seasons in one day, we do get to see the four seasons and how it evolves. And like this time of the year, with the deciduous trees losing their leaves, then you get that beautiful light coming in. And, of course, the autumn colours, very special. Yeah, it's wonderful what the trees do.
They really are the indicators of the season.
Yeah.
I remember, too, when I asked you, how did this design come about? Did you draw it on paper? And you said to me, because I was studying landscape architecture at the time, and you said to me, we walked it out and it felt organic and it felt like the right thing to do, but you just did it on the land. You didn't use paper and pencil.
No, for a little while I couldn't make the move to the Highlands after we purchased it, but I did do a little bit of drawing, but again, mostly because I didn't have the experience, but also, as you said, I do like that organic feel where I like to walk around the property. And the other thing that I wanted to do from the onset was to do a minimal disturbance to the land, like levels and so on, just work with the existing slopes and so on that we've had. So that was important. And people do tell me that maybe I do have a sense of, some people it comes naturally how you get a feel of the space that you're working with and you're getting the proportions right.
Yeah.
With the length of some of your hedges or how you propose to work with the size of your land and how everything fits in. To me, it's like your house really, and particularly we're working with different garden rooms as well. Everything had to be proportionally right, I guess. And
I think you've got that natural feel for scale, proportion, where a lot of us struggle. And I think also you have a very keen eye for volume and void and pinch points. So you bring people in to a gateway or an entrance or a view, and then you let them expand out into a space, like the ballroom.
Yes.
So I think so you move in and then out and then in and then out, and it feels so natural and it feels like every single room is a voyage of discovery. And even though you're going which way, every which way, and it's a bit like Hidcut, really, where you're entreated to the next room by a glimpse.
Yes, actually, a lot of people do make that comparison, particularly with Hidcut Garden, mainly sometimes because of the different garden rooms, but also like the Beach Hedge, where the simplicity and how all that flows into a very busy, because this garden is full on. There's not a space that is not exercised, where you're not juxtapositioning a plant or putting a collection of plants together, create pictures. And that's another thing that I do too, is vistas are important, but every area in the garden is also small pictures that pulls together that creates the bigger picture. Every area is like a painting, and I see it like a frame, whether I use a plant or maybe a walkway or the lawn or your hedges, and then the vistas draw you to another part of the garden and you just continue seeing that. It could even be a play, you know, it's just like a play as well, but to me it's like a ever-changing painting,
yeah.
The garden.
And I think that looking at that artistically,
yeah,
that brings a garden to a different level.
Yeah, you do. And even though, I mean, I have learned a lot of things over the years, like the importance of textures in the garden rather than the colour. And of course, we never forget the colour, because in this garden, the colour is very important and it's used over and over again. I guess with the scale of the garden and how the foliage pulls together, it works, I think. But you do appreciate, in the end, the quality of the foliage and the structural plants that really pulls the garden together. And we're talking about, of course, trees and shrubs and areas of some of the more structured areas, like, for example, the Abbess garden, where you have very strong lines of box hedging and the cones and all that. But inside planting is very much exuberant and cottage-like and full of colour and all that, and it pulls all that together. It's
absolutely
just like a lovely framing.
I think that's the magnificence of this garden, is its general formality.
Yes.
And then it's completely jam-packed with treasures.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just intensive horticulture.
Yeah.
So you're lucky because you're in Sutton Forest.
Yes.
You've got the cool winters and the clay loam soil that is favoured by gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
And that's perfect growing conditions for roses. And you have some 200 roses in the Red Cow Farm collection. What roses have you always favoured?
I actually started with very much the old-fashioned roses, Bourbons and a lot of the ones flowering roses, like different Gallicas, like Charles de Milt, for example, some Damask roses like Madame Hardy, Bourbons like Madame Isaac Perrier, Madame Ernst Calvay, Souvenir de la Belle Maison.
Mm.
These were all,
the
again, they're
point.
Such beautiful classic roses as well, mainly because majority of these have good growth habit. They're strong growers. The flower shape, the style of the flowers that I like, which is that cabbage,
yeah,
style. The perfume, of course, which is very important. All of our collection of roses here, they do have strong perfumes. That's usually very much on the high wish list when we're selecting roses to put in the garden.
Where were you introduced to those old roses? Was it in Australia or overseas?
It was here in Australia. I did a garden for my parents in Sydney, and it was a bit of a discovery. And then I have discovered a couple of old rose nurseries. I don't think they're in place anymore, like Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey's nursery.
Yes, the Ramsey's, yeah.
Yeah, and they were very, very helpful to me making a decision on some of the roses. And it was actually quite a revelation to find even simple things like that. You have climbing roses on the roses that actually grow more than a metre. So it was quite a discovery. And then, of course, I started having love affair with the old-fashioned roses and didn't stop. And a few years down the track, I was itching to find a property that we can actually lay out and then start using a lot of these roses in the garden.
Well, I know that your criteria for finding a prized rose is good, strong growth, good flowers. It doesn't matter if it's single or double, but it has to have a perfume.
The perfume is, but it's very important. I make exceptions too, where the rose is too beautiful, where the the perfume. We have to forgive her for not having a perfume. But
well, there's always exceptions.
Yeah.
How many do you plant in a patch? Just one, or do you go three? Or
no, I normally like to plant, depending on the growth habit of the rose, but generally, particularly like the David Austin roses, for example, majority of them, I like to plant 3, 5 to 7, depending on the area and how much impact I want to make within that area.
So obviously if you're planting 7, you know, you've got 2.5 hectares, but yeah. You've also got, that's a broad brushstroke. That's a really substantial display, isn't it? When it gives great presence in the garden.
Yes, because I think like a lot of the modern shrub roses, and there are some very good roses becoming available now that has all the qualities that I look for, but generally a lot of them roses intend to be upright growing, so they don't grow as wide. So this way, if you say planting 3, even 2, you're getting a substantial looking shrub rose or a plant where it looks like one plant.
Yes,
but
that's right.
In effect, actually, I look at the roses just like we do with perennials in the garden.
That's right, me too. And in my smaller garden, I always plant 3 of my shrub roses together in a little triangle.
Yeah, it makes all the difference.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So we've sort of looked at your criteria for choosing roses.
Yes.
You've chosen, you've got 200.
Yeah.
Where do you purchase your roses these days?
I still scrutinize some of my local nurseries, and I usually do that early, probably about mid to late autumn when a lot of the bare root roses starts to arrive. Then there are some of the nurseries that the mail order nurseries or nurseries that specialize like Ross Roses in South Australia, for example.
Yeah.
I go to great lengths depending on if I'm looking for a particular rose. Like many years ago, I planted a rose called Marshall Neal. It's the most beautiful climbing rose. For some reason, I've lost it or I've taken it, and I can't remember why I did that. But then the last 2 to 3 years, I've been searching for one, and it's been nearly impossible to get it. And luckily, I managed to get one. And then Ross Roses were very kind. They did locate 3 for me. And now I have 4 to plant in the garden.
Well, that's Margaret Ross, isn't she? She's an absolute darling.
Yeah.
Absolutely,
she was very helpful.
Her.
And she came back. And I actually ordered more roses from them last year. At the moment, for example, tea roses are sort of a bit of a favourite, so I've been planting quite a few of those.
Well, you know, when we discussed what your favourite roses were, you gave me a list of 61.
Yeah.
Now, we can't talk all about every 61 of them, but we have sort of whittled you down to 7 that I'd love you to give me your opinion on.
Yes.
So let's start with Jude the Obscure, fabulous David Austin.
Jude the Obscure is one of David Austin's best creations. It doesn't, of course, like the wet climates, which in Australia in general, we don't have that issue.
No.
And it has everything, particularly in Australia. The growth is very strong, unlike he describes when he's talking about that particular rose. It grows very well. I find that it repeats extremely well. And, of course, the perfume is quite exceptional. It's one of the best perfume roses.
You've planted it in the Abbess Garden.
In the Abbess
sunken,
Garden,
isn't
there's
it?
7 of them together.
And the fragrance really just becomes trapped in that sunken garden.
That was the idea. Actually, that was part of the garden where, of course, the roses predominate, because initially that was going to be mainly perennials and mixture, but then I've decided to concentrate on mainly roses in that area. And then,
can you describe the fragrance of Jude the Obscure?
It has like what do you call it, the
passion fruity,
and also like the sweet wine, you know, the sticky.
Oh, the sticky, yes.
Yeah, that's sort of a perfume. And then it has guava perfume, some bit of a hint of tropical, but these are all very refined fragrances that pulls together. So the perfume is extremely refined.
Okay, so let's head to another David Austin that I know that you love, Charles Darwin.
Charles Darwin, now that's become quite a favourite since it's released to Australia. I love the colour. It has
the palest of clotted cream, really.
Yeah, it's clotted cream, and then it's actually, then it goes to a beautiful mustard colour. These are just like Jude the Obscure as well. I compare them to some of the peonies that we hold to our hearts, but we have to accept the fact that we'll see them about 3 weeks of the year, maybe, if you're lucky. And then we have to put them aside until the following year. So we seem to be getting that in the roses, and of course with their exceptional perfume.
I suppose it's that cupped shape that this rose has that reminds me of a peony as well. It's cupped
and... Yeah, it does. And actually, Jude Dubsker, I must mention, just briefly going back to that, it never opens fully.
Yeah.
So it remains like a...
Ball.
Full, like you get in the peonies.
Yeah.
So Charles Darwin does a similar thing, but it does open up to show its centre.
And I know you say it's one of the biggest of the David Austins.
It's one of his biggest. It's the flowers are particularly first flowering, which a lot of David Austins, the flowers are the biggest. Biggest doesn't mean almost mean best, but Charles Darwin is probably about 12 to 15 centimetres it can be in this spring, its first flowering. But at the same time, the flowers are very refined.
All right, let's head to Rambling Rector.
Rambling Rector, okay. The name is probably a little trivial. I think it was introduced by Pemberton, who did all the lovely hybrid musk roses, if I'm not wrong. But nevertheless, it's such an extremely generous rose when it's in flower, like a lot of the rambling roses. It's that beautiful, clear, luminous white with just a hint of lemon in the centre.
Mm.
The whole effect is just a froth of white.
And you've got it in a sort of semi-wild area of the garden.
Yeah,
and it kind of clambers around.
Yeah.
But it can grow quite vigorously, can't it?
It can go quite vigorously. 2 years ago, I had a major cutback, which I sometimes do to make adjustments, of course. But it usually it climbs onto a tree. In our case, it does both the tree into our cherry laurel hedges as well. So it shears down. It's almost like a snow when it's also dropping its petals, but the perfume again on that is quite exceptional. It's very sort of a lemony, sort of rosy, you know, like the old-fashioned, almost like a damask rose, but more on the lemon side.
Now, I love this other one that you've got because it rambles over the shed and it climbs beautifully over walls as well. And
oh,
that's,
yes,
of course, apple blossom.
Apple blossom, yes.
It's more pinky, isn't it?
That's more pinky, yeah. Hence the name. It's almost like apple blossom flowers, but it's a little darker. But I think because the flowers come in such profusion that it gives it an effect of a much sort of a darker pink than it is. The flowers are single in this case. The perfume is not messy, but it does have enough perfume to, I think, please most of us. And the good thing about it is its ability to cover a shed or cover even an unsightly area.
Just looks great with corrugated iron, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Just that lovely tone of rusty corrugated iron and galvanized. Looks amazing. All right, let's go to William Shakespeare 2000 because it's such a good rose with a deep crimson color.
Yes. The good thing about William Shakespeare 2000 is, again, I still prefer, like all the David Austins, I prefer to plant them in 3 or 5, and the ones we have in the garden is about 3 of them together in this instance. But it does have quite a growth habit. It grows as wide as tall, so it mixes in quite well to make a lovely big shrub. Now, the good thing about William Shakespeare 2000, of course, is colour and the formation of its flowers and the fantastic perfume.
It's a knockout,
isn't it?
It
has what we call the... you know, the old rose perfume.
Yeah. Okay, Tea Clipper. That's another David Austin, isn't it? But it's a beautiful performer in your garden.
The quick story with Tea Clipper is I planted a few years ago when it was first released to Australia. There was another climbing rose which I had to get rid of, move out, I should say, Goldfinch. And Tea Clipper was getting too much competition and shade, I think. So since Goldfinch has been taken out, they just haven't looked back. They've just been performing so beautifully. The flowers, like a lot of the roses, can vary from very much a temperature dependent. It can vary from almost to pure yellow, but most of the time it's showing its most beautiful shades of apricot into buff colors. And the perfume, beautiful, lovely formation of flowers. And it seems such a generous rose.
I love it.
That
sort of fragrance of a mix of tea, myrrh and fruit.
Exactly, yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
All right, so just finishing up, we probably need to just look at the rose care, your strategies for good, strong rose growth.
Okay.
You've got great soil, you've got a great climate, so you're winning on that account. let's go through the row care. Let's just, what do you do with mulching?
Okay, with the mulching, in general, the whole garden is a mulch, and particularly where the roses are grown, we mulch it every year, and generally it's with mushroom compost. I do try and avoid the first year, firstly planted roses, I try and avoid any contact if I can with the mushroom compost, but after that it's all fine. We go back to mulching them again, and some years we might be mulching a bit of bark, but we still top it with the mushroom compost because it looks good and it helps the bark break down.
That's such
well.
A great tip.
Yeah.
All right, fertilizing. I mean, we all use rose fertilizers. How often do you do that?
Again, the mulching is, it gives us a good start for the season.
That's right.
And because we are in a cool climate area, I don't fertilize our roses until, with the timing, is about September for us.
Yeah.
Because our first flush of roses don't arrive till about mid-November.
Yes, that's right.
There are exceptions, like some tea roses and noisettes and so on, there earlier. And these days, I always use the organic fertilizers, perhaps Sudden Impact or maybe Organic Life or something similar.
Yeah, they're the two
particular ones that has the mixture of good trace elements in them, I find quite useful.
Now, look, pruning. A lot of us get confused, particularly about the once flowering roses. So
yeah.
They're the older roses that just have their once a year flowering. You prune them, you don't give them a winter prune, do you?
I do, but what I do is generally a lot of the shrub roses that are once flowering, we do get very busy here in the garden at the time when we do need to prune them, and usually it's months soon after they finish their flowering. So it means that we can prune them, and then the rose puts enough growth back to, because they flower on the old wood.
That's right.
So they can develop the growth for the following season.
So, all right, so what's your strategy with tea roses?
With the tea roses, most of the tea roses have horizontal growth as well as keep growing upwards. The majority of the roses, tea roses in Australia, are very strong growing roses. So generally, with the tea roses, they cleanly drop the flowers and they don't set seed heads mainly. So there is no need to deadhead to actually keep getting continuous flowering. Occasionally what I do is if the rose starts to look very straggly or leggy, just doesn't look right in its place, I may give them a bit of pruning and so on. But otherwise, I just leave them alone and give them the space required to form the natural shape of the rose.
Obvious to us when David Austin's became so popular, and that they had a very different habit and growing structure to how they grow in England.
Yeah.
With David Austin's in particular and their sort of rambunctious, rambling growth, do you do any training or pinning them or creating more sort of horizontal stems?
No, the majority of the roses, David Austin roses, you can do them, but there is no need to. You get roses like Gertrude Jekyll, which throws enormous, what we call the water shoots, mainly around midsummer.
Yep.
It's almost, you can actually treat those as a climber, but we normally cut those back. I cut them pretty hard and encourage the rose to just remain bushy. The pegging, to be honest, I don't practice it as much as maybe I should, particularly with some of the old bourbons where they put on a very big leggy growth, that you can actually peg those down. So the rose flowers all through the canes.
And I think that's what's so nice about visiting your garden, is that you allow these climbing roses to become substantial shrubs.
Yes.
So you're not pruning them down to nothing each year.
Yes. Like some of the climbers, to actually, if they have these strong canes that are self-supporting, I treat them as very big shrubs rather than climbers. And certainly if you've got the space, you can certainly exercise that and grow them as such. I mean, the good thing about roses, the climbing roses, because they take very little space if you're climbing them vertically, you know, and in that process, you can get quite a few roses in the garden without needing all that extra space.
Well, as a constant gardener with a never-ending list of gardening jobs, I suppose deadheading is on the top of the list, because some of your roses will flower for 10 months.
Yeah, to get a good continuity with roses, of course. Roses, quite a lot of the roses actually, they do tolerate drought, but I think it's always important to make sure that the ground is kept evenly moist. As we said earlier, we're on a clay loam, so our soil is more moisture retentive, but I can see in gardens where gardening in sandy soils and all that, you have to really look at the availability of water or moisture to the plants. But deadheading, we like to go around and deadhead as virtually a ritual during the seasons where deadheading starts once the roses are finishing their first flush. And after all, we do expect so much from our roses, so deadheading is actually going to keep giving us more repeated blooms.
And and obviously with the soil moisture, keeping them at an even sort of moisture is preferable to letting them dry out.
Yes, and then you hope that you don't get too many very hot days. Somehow you do get your smaller flowers, and of course, particularly some variety of roses, the petals cannot support that heat, so they collapse very quickly.
And with your climate, you're not getting the black spot or the other
black spot
fungus
we get.
Diseases?
The rose season, it was quite exceptional. None of our roses showed any black spot at all and generally we expect some black spot to arrive after their first flush is about over. But I don't run and look out for spraying them. What's important, I think, is that giving them good fertilizers with good trace elements and looking at more so growing them well below ground. I think it's very important how the roses can get through the problems of like black spot. Again, luckily we are lucky that we don't encounter some of the problems as major. If we get very wet summers, and we have had that of recent years, you get to see more black spot in the garden, but I just let the plants deal with it. And
it's a bit of a never-ending battle in my climate.
Yeah, I know the fact that in a more humid climates and more climates with the growing range is much higher, like, you know, you're in a higher zone, like zone 9 or 10 or so. I know it's much harder for roses. And of course, insecticides we don't use either, and none of the spurs, even the organic ones we don't, because we encourage a lot of bird life here.
Yes, and it is. It's an absolute delight. Walking around your garden is one of the pleasures of life, and I know that it's a very popular garden for people to come to because you are open really from late September every day up until May.
Up until late May, actually,
yeah. Yeah, and then you close the garden, and do you get a rest, Ali?
No, that's when the work begins. Because, for example, more roses. Today I'm putting up some perennials that, of course, I haven't had the opportunity to plant in the ground yet, and we will be doing them soon, but they need to be upgraded, so to speak. A lot more planting to go. Because we are a collector as well, gardening is never-ending, but it's a joy at the same time.
It is absolutely a never-ending pleasure, and I'm thrilled to be able to speak to you about your garden. It's been one of my favourites for such a long time, and it just keeps getting better and better, Ali. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. That is Ali Mentish from Red Cow Farm at Sutton Forest in the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. Put it on your bucket list to visit. It's a garden for every situation, for every season. It has an absolute collection of perennials, of ornamental grasses, of majestic trees, and a delightful design that just takes you through. You could get lost in it for hours and hours. For more information, head to Ali's website, which is redcowfarm.com.au. And for those who want to see some photos of Ali, you can head to his Instagram page, where he updates quite often. It's lovely to get his daily updates, but also to the Garden Clinic website, where we've written a really lovely article about Ali and his love of roses. And of course, that's gardenclinic.com.au.
Hi there, Graham Ross. Now, you all know I love gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is just simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol helps with root development? This means that sea salt treated plants have a greater access to water and nutrients in the soil. This goes for everything in your garden, from your lawn to your roses, even your veggie patch. So don't just water your garden, sea salt your garden.
Don't forget the sea salt.